isn't just a cult. This is a cabal. This is an assemblage. This is hurly-burly. This is disquiet. This is poetry. This is fiction. This is reality. This is bedlam. This is a book review. Okay, I guess it's more like a series of reviews. Hey there, Bjorn Orange here. Lately, I don't know why, maybe people have run out of media to consume or something, but anyway, I've been getting emails through the website along with some DMs on Insta and the Twitter account. Questions about what I'm currently reading. This happens from time to time, but it has certainly increased as of late, so I thought that I would post some notes for anyone that's interested. I do read a fair amount, and it tends to be a little all over the place, although I do have a particular fancy for alternate history. The Yiddish Policeman's Union by Michael Chabon is an all-time favorite. What's that line? God, I'm horrible at this. It's something like, he could read a comic book by the light of a burning man. He could read a comic book by the light of a burning man. Jesus, that's some fucked up shit. of course, what else? Alternate history. Philip Roth's The Plot Against America is brilliant. Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle. Fatherland by Robert Harris. Alternate history authors love Hitler and the whole Third Reich as subject matter. What if Hitler was never born? What if the Nazis won the war? What if Hitler's art career had taken off? Would anyone give a fart if Adolf got a dart in his heart near the Mart of Stuttgart? It's fascinating stuff. Okay, so, let's see. What have I been reading as of late? The first thing that comes to mind is a book titled Astray, Off Track, and Forgotten by J.A. Damon. This is it's sort of a supernatural adventure mystery that came out on Six Seasons, which I believe is a division of Fox and Lily Press. All right, how do I describe this? Well, it takes place in the near future when deep sea submarine cruises are all the rage. The book opens when one of these submarines, the Orchid, washes up on shore of some mystery location. We don't know where. It's tropical. No one knows how they got there. The entire crew is missing, and all that the remaining passengers have to eat is a pallet of crab-flavored potato chips. At the center of the book is a ragtag cast of characters. To start with, there is this Silicon Valley superstar named Tessa that can build just about anything out of nothing. There's this dude, Quentin, who is the heir to an aluminum foil fortune. He's sort of a dick, but maybe he's actually a good guy, you know, deep down. Higgins is a guy whose parents died in a plane crash when he was 8. Everyone loves him. Magdalene had, what was her deal? Magdalene had base jumped the 27 tallest buildings in the world before boarding the submarine cruise. She's got a lot of skills, but she's a real loose cannon. Marco was developing a cure for a rare form of cancer that killed his son. He's pretty narcissistic. Pete was an artist specializing in sculptures made of his own hair and repurposed straws. And Andromeda was, I guess a model or a singer, maybe a singer-actor, possibly from Senegal or Michigan. Really striking. Won't reveal anything about their past. Scares the shit out of the rest of the people. But they end up being the most dependable of the bunch. Okay, yeah, that's about all I'm going to say on that. I don't want to give anything away. There were a bunch of other characters too, but those were sort of the main ones. The book was about 400 pages, and the chapters had a lot of flash forwards and flashbacks, along with alternate sort of multiverse elements. There was this whole thing about how this abandoned location where they came ashore had once been something of a zoo or a secret government installation or something maybe religious, possibly a CIA-run tiger temple. There were rogue magicians in the jungle, along with mind-reading kittens. I had to start taking notes in a tablet to follow everything. It was really complex and confusing. My favorite scene was when, and I'll try to do this without spoiling anything, it was when three of the ones from the place, well, you don't need to know that, but when those three kicked the asses of one of the others and the one with, let's say, special power. That was cool. That was fucking cool. Way fucking cool. I was also shocked when Pete fucked Marco and then Magdalene killed them both. That was weird. Didn't see that coming. So yeah, I would recommend Astray, Off Track, and Forgotten by J.A. Damon. It's a solid read, especially if you have seasonal allergies or are using a lot of cold medicine. I give it 4.3 stars. It also reminds me of...
We have to go back.
Okay, what else? What else have I been reading? Oh, right. I like reading biographies. It's cool to get to know people. I like comparing my life to the lives of others. If you pick some real losers to read about, then you can feel great about yourself. I like books about redemption. Fuck-ups that keep going lower when you thought there was nowhere else to go. Cringeworthy stuff. Because, you know, it hits a little too close to home, but yet goes a little farther than you, so at least you have that going. It could be worse, right? You're not that fucked up. But then they get their act together and everything's all right in the world. And if they can do it, so can I. Right? Or maybe I read something about a nobody from nowhere who isn't quite a fuck up, but after years of languishing and not being recognized for their talents, gets rewarded through mass appreciation and acclaim. You know, inspirational shit. Along those lines, I just finished a memoir about this dude from West Texas, a little town between Amarillo and Lubbock. He grew up in a low-income, small-time ranching family. The book describes his relationship with his parents, a mother that kind of worshipped him, and a father that, although kind, was sort of distant and maybe even a little jealous of him. After a few chapters relating a pretty awkward adolescence filled with self-doubt, confidence issues, and an inability to connect with others, our protagonist joins his older brothers who have been working as day laborers at a construction site located on the Gulf of Mexico. This is just after leaving high school. Our hero doesn't have any skills per se, but he's a hard worker. He is also observant of what is going on around him. The houses that they are building are located inside a ritzy gated community. It's a place where once he and his brothers have completed the work, they're never going to be allowed back in those gates. He witnesses a lot of prejudice and mistreatment of the workers during this period, and it had a profound life-altering effect on him. He starts spending his lunch hours and time after work learning from other laborers about social justice and community activism. Eventually, he takes the small amount of money that he's been able to save, says goodbye to his friends and family, and heads out on a quest for knowledge that takes him to far-flung locations around the globe. He spends years studying with philosophers in India and Nepal. There's some really, really crazy shit that happens in Europe where he kind of loses himself in hedonism for a bit. Then after like 10 or 11 years, he heads back home. No one has heard of him since he left. His hair is all long and he's got this beard. His family doesn't even really recognize him at first. Things have really changed in his old hood. More and more corporate farms have bought up all the land. Crazy laws have been put in place that only seem to apply to the have-nots. He can't stand it. He starts talking to everyone who will listen about this inequality. He starts talking about how they deserve better and they can have something fair if they just organize and work together. If they unite, they can drive the fat cats off the land and they can have a community built by them for them. So that's all the background to how this guy became a leading agent for equality and justice throughout Texas and then the United States and even now the world. The last third of the book outlines the work that he is currently doing in regards to destroying the for-profit, corporatized penal system in America, abolishing the death penalty, making sure that quality healthcare is available to everyone for free, improving access to education, attacking the wealth gap, and addressing climate crisis. This is one of those memoirs that goes into the category of inspirational. At the same time, you know, I was feeling like, wow, what am I doing with my life? And then, you know, hey, look what I can do with my life. So, good stuff. All right. The book is called Walking the Path of Deliverance by Jesus de Nazareth. I give it 4.5 stars. Oh, and there's this song that was inspired by it.
On my all-terrain vehicle, until I reached my boiling point. Body double now, past the joint. Good looking, God fearing, go insane. Good looking, God fearing, go insane. By the dozens, we're laughing at your cousins, 'cause the poison stands deeper in the water that we creep in. Stewing fuckings by the dozens, we were laughing at your cousins, 'cause the poison stands deeper in the water that we creep in. Drugs sent overnight, descending order to your right. On easy street with easy rock, an elder statesman on the clock. Good looking, God fearing, go insane. By the dozens, we were laughing at your cousins, 'cause the poison stands deeper in the water that we creep in. Spilling fuckings by the dozens, we were laughing at your cousins, 'cause the poison stands deeper in the water that we creep in.
What is the definition of a novella? I kind of think it is something longer than a short story, maybe 40 pages, but not over 100 pages. Anyways, I want to recommend this novella I read a little while back, A Custom Continental in an El Dorado 2 by Ingrid James. 82 pages packed with observations from a neighborhood in South Chicago circa 1990. It kind of reminds me of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, which came out around the same time. It's a hot summer, and we meet all these personalities. They're working at the local car wash, they're hanging out at the park, they're doing all kinds of things. Heat-induced tensions begin to mount, fingers start wagging, this one is that one is this. It ends with a classic, hey, we're all basically the same, so stop all your judging and let everyone be the person that they want to be. If you aren't stealing my bike or punching my nose, then you're all right with me. That's kind of the sentiment. But you know, I mean, I like these kind of books. I mean, they're a good reminder, and I love the way that James gets there. The book originally appeared in installments, I guess. It was like in the Atlantic Monthly or maybe the New Yorker, I'm not really sure. It kind of had a moment in the early 1990s, but this is the first time that I had ever read it. I looked it up, and Ingrid James, who was really unfamiliar to me previously, appears to be one of those author's author types. No bestsellers, but all the big-time writers rave about her and praise her as inspiration. I even found a little ditty that was inspired by the book.
So here's a few. Just like you, the list is true. Dr. Henry, George Monroe, Papa Sansa, Ben Fogger, Jimmy Hayes and Laura Pabst, John DeVue and Fritz Milan, Tyra Lloyd and Vincent Hatz, the True Brigade and Warren Bland, Tom Barone of Ted's Big Band, Dr. Reba Happenstance, Holly Sess and her Rosetti, Bobby McKenzie, Tyrone Bentley, Ace Mizuni and the Q2, wash the cars at Mobile Mats, and the guys who fix all the flats. Little Randy Andy gave the monkey till Doomsday. A picture of Daddy's app right next to her toothpaste. And you know it's true, no matter what you do, if you're 4'11 or you're 6'2", if you're on the phone or you're locked up in a room, if you've got tattoos or you're pushing a broom, if your body land or Mercedes Raul, if you live in Spain or you were born in a zoo, I'm here to tell you she's just like you. If you're a refugee or still stuck like me, if you make the boots work or you live in a tree, if you're full of love or you like to be mean, if you're alabaster or you're a clementine, if you're red, white, and blue, if you're red, white, and green, if you're green, red, and black, if you're red, white, and blue, if you're red, white, and blue, if you're red, white, and blue, that girl's just like you.
Do you like William S. Burroughs, A Junkie's Christmas, or Naked Lunch? Possibly Messages to Central Control by A.D. Hitchin. I'm talking about any of those authors that use the cut-up method for non-linear storytelling. You know, the stuff that was kind of inspired by Dadaism. Well, there is a recent anthology called About to Lose Our Shit. It's available from Do We Forgive Mother, which is a publishing company in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm guessing that if you're listening to this podcast, you are familiar with a cult member here, Chris Campbell, also known as The Creeping Man. He has a new album titled Nothing to Be Afraid Of. Woven into Chris's dark ambient sound are bits of found audio from public domain films. It has its own ephemeral-based Dadaist approach. So there's this group of Minnesota writers, either in collaboration with the Creepy Man or maybe it was in celebration of the album, I'm not sure. But they created short stories based on the titles of each of the 12 tracks, which had already been inspired by those public domain films. Make sense? So the book, About to Lose Our Shit, features, for example, Janelle Doublewhite creating a mind-alternating noir from the near future where attitudes are illegal and nothing is allowed to be wrong. It's based on track 4, Karen Blanche Ziegler, from the album Nothing to Be Afraid Of. New Ulm, Minnesota's premier angst penciler, known cryptically as The Dentist, turned in chapter 5, which is titled Betty. This is probably the most Burroughs-esque work in the collection. He or she, no one really knows the gender of the dentist, employed the use of the cut-up method with an August 1947 Uncensored Detective magazine, along with several pamphlets describing the conditions of sexually transmitted diseases from the same era to create a deep deeply disturbing story that will prevent you from ever eating waffles again. As far as my personal favorite selection from this book, that is a tough choice, but I think I would have to go with Chapter 8, Joe is about to lose his shit, which I assume inspired the title for the collection. Continuing with the general concept, Pat Heiderschmidt, who teaches first grade at a Montessori school in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, handed his students copies of books that the local library was discarding. He then had his students cut out words using their alligator safety scissors, and then, collectively, they used paste to adhere the words to construction paper as they saw fit. Subsequently, Heiderschmidt took those pieces of construction paper back to an art collective located in Lower Town, St. Paul. After a preliminary activity involving absinthe and mescaline, members of the collective used X-Acto blades to cut the pieces of construction paper into 1-inch strips, which then they adhered to each other's naked bodies using a honey solution. Lining the members up on a stage, the third French horn player from the St. Paul Orchestra read the story aloud. It was transcribed into a Google Doc at that time, and then that document was later translated into Japanese. Then it was translated into Korean. This continued for several more languages, with it ultimately coming back around to English. The result is an adorable tale of a stuffed bear named Joe with a foul mouth and a quick temper. However, his friends on Enchanted Island teach him the true meaning of life, compassion. It alone is worth the price of the anthology. Can't recommend it enough. 5 stars. Here's a little sample from the original source material.
What do you think I am, a prostitute?
No, Betty, I don't. I'm only concerned about your health.
So?
Look, Betty, you have gonorrhea.
So, you remember the burning sensations when you urinated?
Well, finally, I want to wrap this up with another book that is a little bit older. I think You Make Me the Professor was originally published in the late 90s in Iceland. I'm only aware of the Icelandic version of the book, but I think the author, Seamus Patrick Kickham, is actually Irish. I don't know what the deal is there. I really don't understand it. To be frank with you, my Icelandic is pretty weak. So I can't guarantee that I fully understood what was going on in this book. But luckily, it comes with lots of illustrations, so you can basically figure it out. First of all, it's a love story. It's about a relationship that spans 6 decades and involves a great deal of cosplay. The story begins, I think, in a Midwestern college town in America circa 1960. A young guy named Sean meets a young lass named Christiana. They are at a house party where a few musicians are performing folk music hits of the day. Sean was dressed as Burl Ives and Christiana had dressed as a lumberjack. And so it begins. We follow these two lovebirds through many phases of their lives. They move to a nudist colony in Oregon in the late 60s. By the early 70s, they're creating and wearing Star Trek-inspired costumes spanning Federation characters and all new aliens. In the 1980s, they are all about rainbows and bright colors. Sean spends nearly 3 years not only dressed as a neon cloud, but truly believing he is a cloud. Christiana is an on-again, off-again sprite and sometimes pixie during this period. They are both totally devoted. It's a complete lifestyle. The book really never explains how they managed to pay for this lifestyle, but if I understand the text, it sounds like there might have been some sex work involved. By the late 80s, Sean and Christiana have moved to Richmond, Virginia and joined an art collective known as Slave Pit, Inc. Sean played third guitar with their musical act known as Guar for a bit while Christiana toured with the band as something of a dancer. Wearing carefully placed band-aids and a set of ibex antlers, she spat goat blood on audience members from a giant bird cage which hung above the crowd. Of course, there was a lot of drugs involved. That started off as painkillers from underground body modification surgeries, but eventually they were both dependent. That explains why there was really nothing mentioned during all of the 1990s. I guess it's something of a lost decade. Around 1999, the two start appearing in some publications devoted to bodybuilding. They had both cleaned up, I guess. At least they were off the opioids, but they might have switched over to human growth hormone. Suddenly, they were fucking beasts. Just huge, just muscle-bound. And then there was a lot more, body modifications. Christiana now had actual surgically installed horns. They weren't big, but they were real. Sean had altered his jaw and his chin to create it like an exaggerated lantern effect. They had both done some weird shit to their eyes. It was beyond just contacts, but frankly, I think I didn't translate that part correctly because I'm pretty sure what I think it said is both completely illegal and physically impossible. They had made themselves into, superheroes or mutants or superhero mutants. You've probably heard of them, the Professor and Princess Ibex. They joined up with some like-minded people and formed an organization called Watchdog, which was sort of a Justice League type thing. And, here's the part I didn't understand. Watchdog. Which I think was some sort of acronym, but it didn't feature any dog-themed heroes. I mean, what's up? I mean, that's like a missed opportunity, right? Anyway, as of 2019, I guess they're both retired. They're going on 80, so, that's probably going to be the way the deal. So, I mean, they're not as active as they used to be, but they're really still devoted to their role-playing. The thing is now their wardrobe, their house, and even language is completely dedicated to their concept of a retired couple from 1953 in Paterson, New Jersey. They drive around in a 1949 Ford. Christiana answers to Midge, and Sean goes by Mac. In all actuality, they reside in Fort Dodge, Iowa. It's a sweet story. It's, it's true love. Also, it provided me a look into a lifestyle that I really don't know much about. But it's something that's, becoming more and more mainstream. So it's a good education. As a whole, I would give this book 4.7 stars. I'm not sure if the two are related, but I do know of a song with the same title. Could be coincidental. You Make Me the Professor. Neurotic, exotic, skillfully
back.
Okay, well, that about wraps up the book selections. Let me know if you want any more. You've been listening to This Isn't Just a Cult, a work of real fiction. This episode was written, produced, and engineered by Bjorn Orange. That's me. If you look at the episode notes, you'll find links to all the music that we featured in the show. So, what did we hear anyway? There was Orchid by the Halcyon Brothers from the album Set Upon by Satellites. Jesus H. Christ on Dramamine by This Isn't Just a Cult from the album Shake Hands with Danger. She's Just Like You by Bjorn Orange. Betty by The Creepy Man from Nothing to Be Afraid Of. And You Make Me the Professor from Sean McNamee's brilliant Long Live the Gold Rush. I would provide links to all the books as well, but of course, these books don't actually exist. I mean, this podcast is a work of real fiction after all. Although these books do not exist currently, because they were discussed, they do exist in the multiverse. Gotta love the multiverse. Just think it and it becomes real. Someplace. Not here. But somewhere that we will never visit. Most likely. Although, now that I mentioned that, there is a slight possibility of visiting alternate realities in the multiverse. That is now a real place. Someplace. Right? Maybe here? Soon? I think that's how it works. You know, seriously, this art collective needs more physicists. Pronto. Like quantum gravity physicists. We got poets and writers and musicians. We need more scientists in this art collective. Okay, that reminds me. This Isn't Just a Cult is an art collective. You can learn more at thisisn'tjustacult.com. Did you like what you heard today? Have you thought about letting others know about this podcast? It's easy to do. Do you have a computer? Great. Take your computer, or really the computer of someone else you know, open up Adobe Illustrator or some other vector graphics editor and create some artwork to help promote This Isn't Just a Cult. Think of it as a logo, clean, concise. Something like, listen to This Isn't Just a Cult, a work of real fiction at www.thisisn'tjustacult.com. Yeah, you're right. Upon further review, that is pretty wordy. Okay, take two. Maybe something more to the point. Like, listen, www.thisisn'tjustacult.com. Vague, I know. All right, but with the right graphics, it could work. How about thisisn'tjustacult.com? Now, 97.7% urine free. To the point and factual. Whatever. You see where I'm going with this. Make something up. Get yourself some of those handy-dandy pre-cut sticker sheets for your printer and whip up 500 or so. Now, head on down to the market. Slap them on some bread or cans of soup. Don't get caught. That would ruin the fun. Then, return home and just imagine someone else, a complete stranger, eating a bowl of cereal for dinner and looking at the box only to see your poorly designed... sorry, but you know it's kind of true. Sticker promoting This Isn't Just a Cult. Well, I'm sure that your design will, you know, make them interested in what the hell is This Isn't Just a Cult. Curiosity will overcome them, and the next thing you know, we'll have a new fan. Someone you might later meet at a This Isn't Just a Cult convention in Seattle. You'll be dressed up as Dr. Machete Petals from Episode 10, and they'll be dressed up as the Creeping Man, Chris Campbell. Sure, this is all pretty unlikely, but it is already gonna happen somewhere in the multiverse, so it might as well happen here. Thanks for listening.